Chinook. It's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
Welcome to Chinook Patterns. In the Arctic Ocean and the Beaufort Sea, a number of studies are being conducted to assess the environmental impact of oil and gas production. Some 50 studies fall under the auspices of the Bureau of Land Management Outer Continental Shelf Office, the OCS, and NOAA, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration. The studies cover every aspect of Arctic biology, with special consideration of endangered species, particularly the bowhead whale. Gary Hufford of the OCS office in Anchorage has the responsibility of overseeing the North Slope studies, which will be used to assess the environmental impact of a proposed oil lease sale planned for December 1979. The potential lease site extends 60 miles west of Prudhoe Bay and to about 30 miles east of Prudhoe and goes for some 20 miles out to sea. The bowhead studies are to determine if there are bowhead whales in that area, and if so, how will oil and gas production affect them.
The Endangered Species Act says that you will not harass or you will not destroy habitat. And that puts the responsibility on the Secretary of Interior then to either remove or modify certain tracts that are for sale by either removing them from the sale or by putting certain stipulations on that will guarantee that that harassment or destruction won't take place. So what we've done to accomplish the objectives with the bowhead is to go out and contract two different studies, one with the Alaskan Eskimo Whaling Commission through Jacob Adams, its chairman, and another contract with the Naval Arctic Research Laboratory acting as a project manager, in which there are eight individual projects in which they are doing actual scientific studies on the bowhead.
Let's get to the contract with the Eskimo Whaling Commission.
Okay, that contract was started in the fall of this last year with the specific purpose of meeting two phases. The first was to record all the information that they now have on their land use records that were put together as part of their Native Settlements Acts of that came about in 1971. That information listed a lot of key spots along the coast where they tried to identify as either culturally important or important environmentally. And what we wanted them to do was to take this information and put it into a utilizable format so we could get some idea about where they hunt them, the bowhead, where they have observed bowheads in the past. The second phase is probably the more interesting part, in which they will actually go out and interview whaling captains from the villages of Wainwright, Barrow, Nuwitsit, and Kaktovik, with the specific purposes of asking them about the unrecorded information. What has your father taught you about where to go to look at bowheads? What have you observed in your years of whaling? Have you seen them mating? Where do they migrate? What certain activities or behavior do you see the whale under certain ice conditions? And so forth. And with that information, we hope for the first time, at least in the OCS program on the Arctic North Slope, to utilize indigenous information from the indigenous people that are there.
And who should know better than anybody else.
They certainly should, about the bowhead. Now, that information will be utilized in a number of ways. Most importantly, it will be put into the environmental impact statement. So that information can be used to show impacts or probable impacts. And secondly, it'll be utilized by the people in the Naval Arctic Research Study so that they will actually know where they might want to go set up their sampling program rather than than go out and start blindly about where you may think the bowheads are. Why not take advantage of people who have been hunting them and know where they're at for years? And by so doing, they've defined our sampling sites.
Now, I'm just a little bit confused. The Naval Research is interested in the bowhead, or where they are and how many there are, for what reason?
Okay, that information is again being utilized to substantiate the native information. That's not to say that we don't trust the native information. There's a difference here. The information coming from the natives is an empirical data. The information that the Naval Arctic Research Laboratory will be collecting is the what one would use as substantiating scientific evidence to either prove or disprove some of the contentions that the natives may put in their data. What this does is help us support that if in fact the migration route of the bowhead goes right through the lease area in the fall, then we must substantiate this. A question is, how many go through the lease area? Is it part of the population? Does the total population go through? And with that kind of information, we can better determine impacts. So the kinds of things that the Naval Arctic Research Laboratory are doing are not just substantiating the natives, but are going into more detail. For instance, one aspect of that study is to collect tissue samples from the bowheads to take a look at such things as their eyes. How well do they see with their eye? And this is important because, as you know, with the latest controversy over the Duck Island problem, one of the concerns there seemed to be with noise. If the rig is very noisy, will this in fact disturb the bowhead? Well, just as important is the question is, can he see it? And if he does see it, how does he react also? So that behavior wants to be looked at, and one can assume a number of things about their ability to see by their musculature and the structure of the eye. Another piece of the tissue that is being used is the flipper. Now,
you have to tell me.
Okay, the flipper on the side of the whale is a appendage that is given to the whaling captain who struck the whale, as it is a sign of prestige, much like an award that one would get. It's considered a delicacy and part of the kill for the hunter. What's of importance now, because they have that interest, they keep that flipper, and many of them have that sometime after the whale has actually been hunted. We have scientists who are going around the villages asking permission to X-ray and photograph those flippers. And one can obtain from an X-ray the bone structure. And from that bone structure, we can tell roughly the age of the animal from the effect of whether it's a pre-adult or an adult. And this is important because we don't really have a good feel for the breakdown in the population that's out there. Are they all adults? Are there a high number of juveniles? This all has a very important role in determining impacts, because if you're impacting all adults, who have a high reproductive capability, then certainly that plays a more important role than impacts done on juveniles.
Okay, let's bring this all back now to the OCS and give us a time frame. These studies are taking place, this information is being gathered. When is it going to be used, and how are you going to use it?
Okay, we use the information at a number of decision steps, and the information now that is being collected will most importantly be used with the environmental impact statement that will be coming out and will be available for public review. Those comments and suggestions that come from that review will be utilized in the final draft statement, and this is where the Whaling Commission report will probably have its biggest impact, since we feel that the timing for that final report will probably be sometime in this late spring. And the final report will be out sometime around the 1st of August.
And that's the final impact statement?
Right, that's the final impact statement.
And that in turn will determine the use of this lease?
That will help certainly in some of the sale decisions. The information being collected by the Navy Arctic Research Laboratory has a two-edged sword. One, not only is it utilized in the EIS, but also we are required by the Endangered Species Act to determine jeopardy for the animal. That determination is made by the National Marine Fisheries Service of the NOAA. And they are, through consultation with us, giving us the objectives of the study, and also will make the determination of how much information is collected and when it's adequate so that they can make a jeopardy determination. So what I guess that means is that that study could go on for the next couple of years, even after the sale. The new OCS Amendments Act gives the Secretary of Interior a lot of new powers such that he can hold a sale. And if evidence comes up later that one of those tracks he sold is critical habitat to the bowhead, he can buy it back.
Oh, I say buy it back. Who is going to buy a tract where they don't know
how
they can use it?
Well, maybe that's not totally fair, because one of the things that one can do in terms of impact sometimes is to put certain stipulations on that track, which says that they have to do certain things, or they can only be there at certain times, and that ends up protecting the animal. So you don't always just end up taking the tract away from them. You can sometimes mitigate, and those are kinds of decisions that are made up at the very high levels of the Department of Interior.
Gary Hufford of the OCS office in Anchorage. He says those high-level decisions are going to be based in part on what the public has to say about the environmental impact statement. There will be public hearings held on the matter around the state, starting in June. This has been Chinook Patterns, and I'm Paula Schiller. Chinook is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.
Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaska Natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into Native heritage, how things are and how they got that way. Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
This is Chinook Profiles. I'm Paula Schiller, and I grew up in Chicago speaking English. Eliza Jones grew up in Huslia speaking Koyukon. Now she's a Koyukon language specialist at the Alaska Native Language Center here at the university. She has helped compile a Koyukon noun dictionary and is in the process of writing a dictionary of Koyukon verbs. That's a long way from when she first learned to read and write the Koyukon language.
I first learned about, you know, this reading and writing the language back in maybe 62 or somewhere around there. David Henry and his wife, who were with the Wycliffe Bible Translators, came to Koyukuk, which is where my husband is from, and we were living there at the time. And I started working with David as an informant, you know, when he'd be writing these words and go all the way across the page, and, you know, I'd have to repeat the word over and over and over for him so he could write it out, you know, and say, would you say it again?
Mm-hmm.
He'd write it down, and I'd say something like, it sort of go up and down right here, and think so on.
Think of a word, and a long word like that.
Well, taq'atl-kul. Okay, that's a long word. Or hodal-qo, or, you know, which means there's fire. And, you know, these words he read on the page, and it seems like it goes all the way across the page of a tablet. And I'd look at it, and I'd think, boy, I'll never learn to write that.
But
and
you did.
He asked me if I was interested, and I said, well, I just didn't know. It looks so hard. And then David Henry got money from the state-operated school to develop some books to be used in the bilingual program in the villages. And they needed some materials. There was no written materials for any, you know, there's no kind of class materials. So they said that, you know, they'd have to train the people to read and write. And he asked me if I was interested. And we had a six-week workshop here where we learned to read and write.
Well, so you learned to read and write, but that means learning the Koyukon alphabet.
Yeah, learning.
Because you already know how to read and write English.
Yeah, but at this workshop, we learned to read and write the Koyukon Athabaskan language.
Okay.
And we had to learn all the...
Is it a different alphabet?
Oh, yeah. Some of it are the same as English, but there are some that you don't have in English sounds. Like, for instance, that's a voiceless L. We write it as a barred L. L with a slash through it.
A different symbol for the different sounds then that don't occur in English.
Mm-hmm. And then we have glottalized consonants, which are when you make it, you pop the sound like K is in English. You know, you already have that in English. And then we have K, which is a K that has a pop to it. So we write it K apostrophe to distinguish.
So it'd be K, like K and...
Uh-huh. So it'll K be K and K.
K and
K. Oh,
I shouldn't even try.
You got it. And then we have what we call the back consonants, which you make way back in your throat. And we have ka, which is like a K, but you make it further back in your mouth. And we write that with right now we're writing it with a double K. But at the time, we were writing it different. It was we were underlining the K. But that's kind of awkward for a typist to type, especially when you have a whole bunch of them. And then we have ka, which is
it's a combination.
Which is a glottalized back K. So we write that with a double K and apostrophe.
It makes very long words, though, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. It looks very long on the page.
Uh-huh. Well, then you were in a workshop learning the alphabet and how to sort of translate the sound you were very familiar with the alphabet.
Mm-hmm.
Then where did you go from there?
Well, let's see. I worked 1 year for the state operated school in developing materials, some school books, and the noun dictionary. It wasn't only me. It was other people that worked on that. Like, when I first went to work here at the university, that was in 1974. But I met Dr. Krauss before that. I met Dr. Krauss, I think, when I was going to the literacy workshop down here. It was the first time that I met him, and I was so impressed with him. You know, he knows so much about the Athabaskan grammar and stuff. And when I went to work for the center, I started studying not only to write the words down, but, you know, start learning little bit about the grammar. And it's, to me, that's a, you know, really exciting part of the work. Figuring out, I mean, that you could, you know, actually write it down and say, this works this way. And you could take a word like, she has fishnet out, tag et kul, and just... you could write the whole paradigm down, you know, I have fishnet out, you have fishnet out. And then he first started teaching me by, you know, making me sit down and write down a whole paradigm. Paradigm means by, like, you know, I did it, you did it, he did it, and, you know, a whole list like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then he taught me, okay, now where's the stem? So we draw a line where the stem is at. And he said, okay, what's the next prefix? And he said, what is that prefix? Is it a subject? What is it? Is it a classifier? And where is the perfective marker? And so on. You know, and you get the whole thing apart. Now he said, now these are the subject and these are the prefixes. And so I, you know, started learning.
And that's exciting.
It's exciting. It is.
Did you find that your students were just as excited about learning it as you?
Well, I don't know if they get as excited as I am, but sometimes I get carried away in class. You know, I'd start working on something and say, oh, this works this way, and maybe I'd lose them, but I try not to do that. One of the things that hard for a student to do is just pronouncing all the different sounds, you know, pronouncing all the different sounds together, you know, pronouncing, mm-hmm. learning to pronounce one sound that's strange to them is hard enough, but when you get a whole string of them, it's really hard.
This is a different subject, but I'm wondering about the very name Athabaskan. I've seen it Athabaskan with a B. I've seen it Athabaskan with a P. And is that a...
With a K and a C also.
Which is, do you know which is right or which is preferred?
Well, officially right now, it's spelled with a B and a K, which
okay.
is...
So it'd be A-T-H-A-B-A-S-K-A-N.
But it's been spelled all four different ways, and if you spelled it in any of the other ways, it wouldn't be wrong. But the official way right now is with a B and a K.
Good, I'm relieved.
And they change it every few years or so.
Now, is that itself an Athabaskan word, or where does that word come from?
From what Dr. Krauss tells us, I guess, told me, maybe he did, maybe he didn't. Yeah, I guess it was Dr. Krauss. Said that the word Athabaskan came, is a Cree Indian word. Cree is... an Indian language in Canada. And he said that there were some surveyors a long time ago was surveying up in Canada somewhere, and they had a Cree Indian as a guide. And they came to this one big lake, and they asked him, what's the name of this lake? And he said, Athabaska, and which means shallow, weedy lake. And there were some Indians living around this lake, and they were Athabaskans. So that's how we got the name Athabaskans.
So your name isn't even in your own language. Did you ever have anybody come up to you and say, do you speak Indian, and have to explain that it's not Indian, it's Athabaskan, it's a different language? Or is that a common mistake, do you think?
No, the most common mistake most people make, most non-native make, is that they think everybody in Alaska is Eskimo. I went to speak to a group, and I told them that I was a Quaker and Athabaskan, and I started talking about, they wanted to know what I was doing, you know. They wanted to know what my work was like. So I started telling them about my work, and I, you know, had some booklets there, and somebody was looking at the booklet, and she said, oh, a book that's actually written in Eskimo. And I guess when I introduced myself, I just took it for granted that they'd know that Athabaskan, Quakon Athabaskan, is an Indian language, or, you know, most people don't know the difference between an Indian and Eskimo. I think it's important to educate the public about the native peoples in Alaska and the different languages and stuff. You know, because so many people don't know any of these things. Even some of the native peoples, you know, like people that live in the city and stuff, you know, they don't really know these things.
Eliza Jones, one of those people who can get excited talking about grammar, words, and about native languages and people. This has been Chinook Profiles. Chinook is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks,